It's Sunday night at 7 p.m. Eastern Time, and therefore, from high above beautiful Lake Osceola in downtown Jefferson Valley, New York, the John Mack Radio Show is on the air. Good evening. This is John McMullen. Welcome you to tonight's show, the 78th in this series. My most recent column for the Westchester Guardian is that website, www.westchesterguardian.com. It is the 155th column in the Creative Disruption series. I hope you'll read the columns, enjoy them, and if the need be, comment to me at johnmack13@gmail.com. And once again, John Mack is J-O-H-N-M-A-C, johnmack13@gmail.com. You'll find links to the previous shows and to my online newspaper at my web home. Try it and subscribe. Only one email per day, www.johnmack13.com. The list of upcoming shows is also at the site. My guest next week is mystery and suspense author F. Paul Wilson, author of the Pam and Jack series. Now, to this show, callers may call in at any time during this show by dialing 646-716-9756. I do hold the online participation of callers to near the conclusion of my interview with my guest. My guest tonight is technologist, technology pundit, writer, and social activist, Leif Felsenstein. I first knew of Leif through his work that process of technology, and later with Osborne Computer. I learned more about social and political activism through Steve Levy's masterful book, Hackers. I know Lee now through our emails and Facebook communications. There has been much more to Lee's long career than this brief introduction has dealt with, and we'll explore all of Lee's interesting life tonight on the John Mack Radio Show. Good evening, Lee.
Good evening.
Bob Franks, then last week's guest on the show, asked me to send his regards. Let's start at the beginning.
Right.
Where did you grow up and go to early school?
Philadelphia. I was born there in 1945, and we moved around a bit. First West Philadelphia, then North Central Philadelphia, a neighborhood called Strawberry Mansion, and then finally in a neighborhood called East Oak Lane. I went to the Philadelphia Public Schools and attended the elite public high school, the sort of college prep high school, Central High School, where I graduated in the 219th class.
Another technology pioneer, Dan Bricklin, and Andy Hertzfeld of the Macintosh development team, and my wife, both came from Philadelphia. My wife predated you and went to Lincoln High School, where she took what was described as the first computer course taught in high school in the country. She worked on a theoretical machine at the University of Pennsylvania's Penn State. She was in the Northeast in the Mayfair section. And then high school. Where'd you go to high school? Oh, you mentioned that, to Central High School.
I said that, to the Central.
Yeah. And then it was off across the country to UCal Berkeley. In those days, most of us stayed somewhat close to home. My wife mentioned as far as Penn State. What took you across the country?
Well, I was interested in leaving home, for one thing. The other point is I had been accepted by Purdue and what was then Carnegie Tech, now Carnegie Mellon, but no financial assistance was forthcoming and I couldn't have afforded it. So Cal was in my second round of applications, but I was pretty interested in the Bay Area from what I had heard about it, and it was a good match for me. I wanted to go there. And it turned out to be, it was very reasonable in price, unlike these days. And when I arrived at Cal in September of 1963, I stood outside among the sea of humanity coursing through campus and said to myself, now I can disappear.
Well, you really didn't disappear, because in your earliest days at Berkeley, you were active in the free speech movement. Tell us about that and your involvement in it.
Yeah, well, my parents were bohemians, in effect. And, I was raised with the knowledge that things were not as they should be, and that we all had some responsibility to do something about it. They really didn't indoctrinate me or anything. And so when the civil rights movement began, and there was some picketing occurring of Woolworth's department store, because that was where the sit-ins were happening in the South, I joined in on my own with various groups. I had no idea what their politics were, didn't care. So I was a bit of an activist when I left, and in Berkeley I sort of joined up a bit with the rather small but certainly larger than Philadelphia contingent of activists there. In my second month in town, I joined in the picket line of Madame New, who is the sister-in-law or something of the then premier of South Vietnam. And Allen Ginsberg was on the picket line, too. I didn't even know how to get back to Berkeley, so I took a cab. But then, and I considered that not bringing myself to anyone's real public attention, and continued my studies in electrical engineering. But the free speech movement more or less caught up with me. Now, there's a story behind this that can be long and involved, and it's in the in the book Hackers, where I joined the cooperative work study program in engineering. Now, that's not the federal co-op work study program, but it was a program that existed at several universities, and it's in the engineering departments. They basically ran a little employment office, and companies would sign up, would create positions kind of like interns, and we could apply for jobs and get hired for the off periods, which meant that you didn't get a vacation. You got 6 months study, 6 months work for an overall total of 5 years. That is to say, entered it in the sophomore year, and you graduated 4 years after that. And I needed the money, and I could do the work, because I knew enough about electronics technician work and so forth. I had taught myself with a friend in Philadelphia starting when I was 11. And my first work-study period was with NASA, Flight Research Center, Edwards Air Force Base, Data Systems Division, Telemetry Techniques Section, Data Systems Division, something like that. And there down at the bottom was me trying to make sense out of things and testing crystal clock or tuning fork clock oscillators and temperature ovens. And that was September, and it started in July, I think, of 64. And to do so, you needed a confidential clearance. It was the lowest clearance level possible. And I filled in the forms and checked the boxes. I was a nice little boy. No, I didn't know any communists and so forth. And then I didn't hear anything. The date approached. I called them up. They said, well, just come on down anyway, and we'll finish the get to the clearance when we finish the investigation. You can see how critical it was. So I did. And 2 months after I showed up there in the Mojave Desert in the summer, like in living in an oven, I was called into the security chief's office and interviewed with someone present. And the questions were, do you know any communists? Well, no, I don't. You know, and on it went. Well, it turns out my parents had been communists. And my brother knew, but I was never told. And this is, as a middle child, I kind of got used to that situation where I never got told things. But this was the process of learning. And basically, they told me to go away, suggested I resign to return to school. And they said, keep your nose clean, because they had, you know, the FBI report had come back, and the guy picketed Admiral Rayburn when he appeared. Who's Admiral Rayburn? That's he was a NATO admiral. And appeared at in Philadelphia. I was picketing with the Quakers, and picketed Edward Teller, Dr. Teller, the H-bomb father, when he appeared. And they claimed the stated reason for my being denied a security clearance was that there was a danger that I might picket the Air Force base. me and who else, I wondered. But anyway, on October 16th, 1964, I took the train back to Berkeley. And the free speech movement had started in September 30th. And I really didn't know what was going on. The L.A. papers were completely distorting it. I thought it was a panty raid riot, like 1952 and 1956. And here I was back in the middle, and there was this revolution going on. And I had to make up my mind whether I was going to keep my nose clean and get back in with those folks, or just keep going and doing what I thought was right. It took me about a week. And I made my mind up and said, okay. And I'm like Huckleberry Finn, you know, all right, I'll go to hell. I'll help Runaway Jim. The free speech movement was an element, let's say, not just an outgrowth of the civil rights movement. It happened because the university attempted to suppress student activity in civil rights activities on the campus and in support of civil rights activities elsewhere. And the students were in no mood in 1964, summer of 1964, fall of 64. That was after Freedom Summer. You know, people had been killed. Lots more people had been brutalized. Really good glimpse. And we had people coming back to tell us what they observed and participated in about the realities of racism in the South. And nobody was in the mood to be meek and submissive when the administration says, well, you can't do that anymore. You can't collect money for civil rights activity elsewhere. You can't, quote, mount off-campus social and political action, which really meant picketing local businesses that were discriminating. And we fought back. And it took several months. And going through lots of stages of negotiation, and then finally resuming demonstrations, you know, rights abandoned or abandoned. And in December of 1964, December 2nd, we walked into the administration building, sat down, 1,000 of us, and 800 or so were arrested, including myself. Now, I was viewing my role there as doing whatever I could to support. I wasn't a leader, and certainly wouldn't consider myself leadership material. But I knew how to handle electronics and a few things like that, and I tried to find things I could do. And I also knew how to run a mimeo machine. That wound up being a lot of what I did. For those who don't know, a mimeograph machine was desktop publishing in its day.
Yep.
You would type onto a stencil, and it would go on a drum with ink behind it, and you turn out paper leaflets. No internet, no nothing. But at one point, something happened that was really formative for me. I was hanging around the central office, and somebody came running in saying the campus had been surrounded by police, which was, number one, not true, but we didn't know that. Number two, it's a pretty absurd statement, because it's a very big campus. To surround it, you know, how do you surround it with anything? Well, something happened there that had an objective reality and a subjective reality. The subjective was how I experienced it. The objective is what actually happened. Objectively, a woman there who was kind of the house mother of the place, self-appointed, knew about my proclivities and skills, and said, Lee, why don't you make us a police radio or something? What I heard was everybody in the place turning to me and in unison saying, Lee, quick, make us a police radio. And I knew what they meant. I knew that in 1939 you could have reached in back of a vacuum tube radio and adjusted a couple of screws and you would get to the move up to the police band, which is right above the AM broadcast band. Try explaining that to a room of people who are hanging on your next word. I just stammered and said, you don't understand. It's harder than that, because, of course, the police band at this by that time had gone up to 50 megahertz and was FM and so forth. And the response that came back subjectively, all in unison, was, never mind about that. Make us a police radio. Now, what happened at that point was I realized, I remembered a construction project, you know, build a police radio, and I could do that, but it would probably take me a month to get it together. And then I also realized that I had been taking the wrong approach. I was waiting for these people who were clearly more intelligent than me. They were studying things like sociology, psychology, poli-sci, whatever that was, political science. And they knew about human society and how people interacted and so forth. And that was one thing I did not know. And so I figured eventually somebody's going to figure out something I can do to help. And I'll, wait for orders. Then I realized in that instant, waiting for orders was exactly the wrong thing to do, because by the time they came around to something, it would sound like this. It would be absurd on its face, and it couldn't possibly do it. So it was, if I wanted to be helpful, I had to take the initiative myself. I had to work on things, decide what to do, more or less on my own. And when this request came in the next time, I could say, well, you can't have that, but here's what you can have. And so, in effect, I was out ahead of the procession in that regard. And that realization has been something that has guided me ever since.
It's funny, the mimeograph had a longer lifespan than any of our computers. My teachers in grammar school were using mimeographs in the 40s, and you were still using them there in the early 60s. So then what happened?
Yeah. Well, then what happened? the free speech movement won its goals, and the administration basically admitted that they would not supersede the operation of the U.S. Constitution on campus in regards to speech and political activity. And at that point, in the break, the winter break, I guess, January of 65, an amazing flourishing of creativity occurred on campus. People started little magazines. Everybody was publishing their own little pamphlets on how they thought things should be done. Somebody asked me to write something up. I had apparently had some ideas and talked about it, and they asked me to write it up on how you would organize a free university. And I did so. I in fact, mimeoed my page of it up, and they included it in a little booklet. And they did such a bad job of the cover of the booklet that the cover was blank. Therefore, you had this little folded batch of paper, and you would open it up, and there's my essay, as if it was the whole booklet. This got mentioned in a New Yorker magazine by their correspondent who went to the campus. But this experience of suddenly everything being possible is something that happens in other revolutions, apparently. And through my readings, I find this. And it was totally intoxicating. One of the things that was happening was, and we didn't know it at the time, was that an unknown number, probably thousands of students dropped out and headed for the Haight-Ashbury and started that. This is the beginning of the counterculture. And a whole lot of other people changed their directions, and I suppose that I would be included in that, but it had already changed back in that at that instant in the police radio incident for me.
I know.
Now, I heard
I know.
Somebody give a talk.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, somebody gave a talk to analyze this, and what they said struck me. They said that because of the crisis, the barriers to communication between people had gone down. And that enabled things to happen that wouldn't otherwise have happened. One point that I think is important is that there was a phone room at the FSM Central. There was two phones on a makeshift desk and an unknown number of pieces of paper tacked to the wall. And this was where people would call in with ideas, they would call in with requests, they would be looking for somebody or something, and the people manning those phones would write the notes and post them and use the notes to make people, to connect people with each other, people outside. And this was a prototypical operation of social media.
Sure.
And one might imagine that a phone room in some organization is dedicated to issuing orders and, you know, polling results and so forth in a very hierarchical up and down fashion. This isn't anything but hierarchical.
Was that
yeah?
No, keep going.
Go on. Well, no.
Was the paper that you wrote for Ben, the Berkeley Bob? I know you wrote for them. For a while.
That came late.
They
started in 1965, and I joined them in 1966 when I had been turned down by the school paper as a columnist.
Was this your first writing experience, the thing that you did for the fold-up paper and the Berkeley Bob? Was that when you first started?
No, from I lived in a co-op residence hall. In fact, I only just found out on its 50th anniversary that it was not university approved, and so it did not require adult supervision. We had to supervise ourselves. We did a pretty good job of it. And we had a house paper, and in a co-op, you have to pay with work as well as money. My work was, I became the editor. I was submitting articles to it initially. I discovered a talent for writing that I had never suspected existed. And that was really even before the FSM. So afterwards, I brought the free speech philosophy to that paper and said I would publish verbatim anything that anyone submitted as long as they attached their true name to it. And this got tested, as you might imagine.
Sure.
And I had to answer for it, but they kept me on. And it worked out. I didn't have a dearth of material, and I didn't, you know, after the first few transient events, really gross, obscene stuff and so forth, and very insulting things to everybody, it all evened out and it worked. So, and of course, I got to mimeograph the paper too. So I would write my articles to fill in the space that was remaining on the stencil. And that's a really good way to train yourself to write.
I know that you dropped out in 67, but you returned to get a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering and Computer Science in 72. What was behind the coming and going?
Well, I can go into as much detail as you want, but to try to keep it overview here. In 1967, I went into a clinical depression, something I had never gotten close to before. And I could go analyze the reasons for it, but I did a lot of that in therapy, getting out of it. And this is not the place for that.
Okay.
I'll go back and review what I was doing otherwise. But this, and for this issue, yeah, in the fall semester of 1967, suddenly I lost all motivation. I could drag myself to classes, but when it came time to do any homework, I would just crash literally into bed, overcome by tremendous lassitude, and sleep until the morning. And I failed all my courses. One course, however, gave me an incomplete. This was Dr. Otto Smith in electrical engineering I think it was controls. He eventually became, let's not run ahead here. I had to leave. I never considered going to the hospital. And when my advisor, and the only time you see your advisor is when you enter and when you leave at Berkeley, said, "Why didn't you?" And I said, "I just never considered it and never thought about it as a medical issue." In those days, the antidepressants they had were kind of crude, and I'm kind of glad I did what I did. So I went, and I couldn't stay in school, but I could hold down a job. So I applied for a technician job at the Ampex Corporation, and I had a little resume of my co-op experience. By that time, I'd had three work periods. So I showed up there applying for a technician's job. They looked at the resume and said, "This looks more like a junior engineer. Would you be willing to take a test?" Well, that's the one thing I had learned at school, is how to take tests. And I did excellently on the test. It was multiple choice, after all. And they sent me to the special products division, which wasn't what I had hoped for, but at least it wasn't the magnetic tape division. And there, that was really my graduate school. I spent 4 years there with a break in itself of several months. But that's where I learned the craft of engineering. I learned about documentation control. They don't teach that at school. And the special products division was a very small division, 150 people, in a company where a division would typically be like 3,000 people at that time. And we had to design and build everything that nobody else wanted to design and build. So these one-off products and so forth, as well as they were working when I got there on improvements in what's called bin loop master high-speed tape duplication hardware. And I wound up designing some electronics for that and saw it through the inevitable gotchas and whoopses, and I thought you meant that kind of things that happened when going into production. And about a year after I did some of that, I walked down a hall and I saw a whole stack of things that I had designed. So it was real. It was actually going out into the field. So I got 4 years of experience doing that. And part of that, there was an interruption. Pardon me, I have the hiccups here. I hope you don't hear it, but there will be these brief interruptions. I didn't begin psychotherapy until after I dropped out of that. I went back to work for the Berkeley Bar, which was a losing proposition. You couldn't make enough money to survive. And then went back to spend a week with my father and talk with him, and he sent me to talk to a psychotherapist, basically around the issue of evading the draft. But this therapist said, "Look, how have you managed to not get into therapy?" And I didn't have an answer for that. He told me I could do it. And so while I was there with my father, I called up my boss, ex-boss at Antex, asked him if he wanted a junior engineer back. They did. So I had my job back and went back there, started in therapy, and that was the end of 1969. So I left there in at the end of 71 in good enough shape so that I could re-enter the university. And it took me 6 months to graduate. So
kind of,
from the academic perspective, that's my career. Go on.
I know that you were one of the early members of Led Zeppelin Computer Club. In fact, Jim Warren told me that you were the MC during the famous Bill Gates hullabaloo about piracy. Tell us about Homebrew and about the Gates blow-up.
Yeah, all right. Let me take a little back up and running start here. Social media. I have been in pursuit of what is now called social media ever since the free speech movement. I continue to search for the right medium, and that's what brought me to the Barb as the underground press, community journalism, and so forth. And I came to understand that the structure of the media was the problem, because most media, but not all, were hierarchical in nature, and so the information all passed through one point and emerged in the same way. Now, certain media like the telephone, post, the mail, and just plain conversation were not hierarchical. And so I gradually began to understand that if I'm interested in facilitating this kind of ongoing revolution, is this continual capability for society to redefine itself, that it was going to have to involve the non-hierarchical media. So I explored there. And in 1970, after having been sent to learn the basic computer language, I'm not sure how many people learn that these days, but it's, you know, English-like. I was sent to a service bureau, which is a company that provided computer services, and since there were only mainframes in those days. And the instructors pointed out that, first of all, their computer, which was not local, it was on a network, and the job kept moving around to other computers on the network, and they could tell that. And they also pointed out that by prepending a certain number of asterisks to your file name, you could make it have an increasing level of public accessibility, so other people could see what you were doing, if you wanted, within certain groups as that you could define. And it struck me that this was a mechanism whereby you could people could form intentional communities of interest. And that it wasn't constrained to any one physical location. It was on the network. So in 1970, I realized what I'm probably looking for is a network of computers. And I remember straightening up and saying, well, where are you going to get a computer? Now, it happened at that time that at Special Products, when I went back there, I had to work on a computer-driven device, driven by a mini-computer. And I even had to learn some little machine language programming to do that, as well as take care of the computer interface hardware. So I had been introduced to computers by my brother in 1959. He was more interested in software, and he started a computer club at Central High School and basically assigned me to be the chief engineer and showed me diagrams from textbooks from the 1940s. Can you make this work? Well, I couldn't say no. Well, it worked. It worked more on a more or less random basis. So I decided I would have nothing further to do with computers. They were too finicky. I would stick with analog electronics. And I did until 1970. Couldn't avoid it. I was hanging around in the There was a computer underground at that point. centered around a publication, really an underground paper called People's Computer Company, which is aimed mostly at teachers and so forth, but really at anybody who wanted to explore kind of strange utopian notions of what you could do with computers. And a big thread of discussion was about what would personal computers be like when they finally arrived. We were keeping tabs on the microprocessors as they were developing. And there was a local group, local potluck that met in Menlo Park. And some people who were at Stanford Artificial Intelligence Lab and some who were at Xerox PARC would deign to show up from time to time. And we would have these discussions. It was a small group of people. There was a guy, Fred Moore, who attached himself to this the place, the Community Computer Center, which is, I called it the People's Pachinko Parlor, because they played computer games there on teletypes, on timesharing lines, and had kids come in and play play games on the computers, which is a pretty radical concept in those days. Kids, computers, did not compute. Fred Moore, he collected names and addresses. He wanted to get some group together to do something. He thought maybe, you know, study hardware or something. Pardon me. And when the Altair computer arrived in 1975, and literally when the first sample unit arrived for People's Computer Company and their coterie to examine, he convened the first meeting of the Homebrew Computer Club in a garage with the guy who owned the garage, Gordon French. I attended, and by that time, now I've skipped over what I did in the meantime involving social media and computers, and I had gotten involved with an outfit, a nonprofit that had secured a mainframe, and right after I finished school, I went to live and work there in a warehouse in San Francisco to try to maintain that mainframe without being instructed in how to do it. And we put up a public access computer bulletin board using teletype terminals in public places. And this was called Community Memory. And it was really, it was a success, among other things. Somebody I'd never really known much, he had been at the same co-op as me, looked me up through this method. And this is Bob Marsh, and talked me into sharing the rent on a garage, and he wanted to start some sort of hardware company. In 1974, this was, and then the Altair popped up, and he knew what he was going to do, and he got me to, without much effort, to design some stuff and do some engineering for him. Okay, so I had had an experience with social media. Starting in 1973 is when we opened the first terminal. And so the Homebrew Club, when I came to that, I brought with me a lot of practices and conclusions, meaning mainly that it was essential to facilitate secondary communication. Now, let me explain. Primary communication is what I'm having with you right now, John. People are listening in, but I'm not really, they can't talk back to me right now, so sort of somewhere else. Secondary information was like the phone number that I called, how to get in touch with you. And we had reached the conclusion with our experiment with computer-mediated, or computer-facilitated, let's say, social media, that the job of the computer was to handle the secondary information, to be able to tell people who the other people were, how to get in touch with them, and then not be in the way. There were other systems like the phone system, et cetera, that would work fine for the non-hierarchical communication. And so I knew I was going to try to bring this to this meeting, and I did. I suggested, I don't know if it was just because of my suggestion, but that we go around the room, there were 30 people in the garage, and each of us tell something about what brought us there, what we're interested in, what we've done, what we want to do, and that somebody take notes. And that was the first newsletter of the Homebrew Computer Club. And that's what the club did. On the fourth meeting of the club, Gordon French, the guy with the garage, he's also a computer programmer, and he had actually built a personal computer, an 8008-based personal computer. And he had to go, had to leave town. He had to go to Baltimore to do a contract for Social Security. And so he could no longer run the meetings. Now, he had been running them in a rather classical, hierarchical fashion, and trying to hold lectures and so forth. And people would go outside during the lectures to meet each other. And I saw this happening. I said, we've got to bring this practice into the meeting. And as of the fourth meeting, I was able to do that. My name was thrust forward by someone who knew me there, and I did not turn it down. So that's when I structured the meeting as mapping and random access. Mapping was handling the secondary information. Random access was the opportunity for primary communication. And that's how we ran the meetings thereafter. So I was up front. Now, what I had to do was learn stagecraft, because the one thing I knew I had not was, should not do is jump into the subject matter of whatever the discussions were. And what I had to do is tamp down the discussion so that people could take that quote offline. They could take it to the random access session. Because looking at people from the front, I could see the lights go out all over the audience when two people got into a yes it is, no it isn't kind of argument. So my job was to break up those situations, and I learned to do that with humor and some stagecraft.
That's interesting. Because I was involved with New York Amateur Computer Club, which I think was the second oldest in the country, and we had a section called Random Access, and I was an officer of the Apple user group, and we also had this section. So the Random Access came from you.
It certainly came. Yeah, I have to admit, it certainly came through me. Whatever it came from, that I got it. But in fact, that was from my experience with the transformation that was the free speech movement. And I could see how that paid off.
So, what was the deal with Gates?
Gates, yeah, Billy Gates. Well, what's known is that he and Paul Allen had written a basic interpreter and attached themselves to MITS, the company in Albuquerque making the Altair. They were offering Altair Basic, and they did a little tour around the country. They were starting computer clubs as they went. You know, they had something to show, and they had a product. And they came to the Bay Area, and in the process, somebody made off with one of the reels of paper tape. And this turned up at the next club meeting. Actually, not just the reel of tape. Several copies of it turned up, because what they did was they brought it to someone who had access to a paper tape punch at work and a system that could duplicate it, and did so. Now, so we were passing around copies of this basic. Now, you have to understand here. The Altair had an 8080 chip in it. The basic unit had 256 bytes of memory. It was a 1K board that was populated with only one chip of memory, and it had four spaces for it. So you needed more memory. Pardon me a second, I'm going to cough. And you read the ad. It said, $397, you can own build your own mini computer. A lot of people went for that and eventually got their kits, and they put them together. It took them far longer than they had expected to get something working. They had to spend perhaps 10 times as much money as they had expected. Nobody in their family knew why they were doing this. There was this promise of a computer at the end of it. And what they got was something that could execute, 100 instructions of the that were cooked into the chip, you know, load, move, store, things like that. And then they were offered the opportunity to spend an additional $150 for this basic interpreter. And, of course, they had also, well, along the way, they'd had to find some way of connecting to the computer because the computer didn't have any input-output other than switches and lights. But fortunately, it was mostly an empty box with slots in it to read cards, and that's what my friend Bob Marsh was busy building, as well as many other people. So basically, what people got was a box that could do almost nothing. And so they had any opportunity to get some software in there that would actually be usable in an interactive fashion, like BASIC, was, in effect, the completion of the project for them. In a way, people felt like they had been baited and switched. And so there was really very little reluctance to copy and pass on this basic interpreter. It turns out, of course, that you know there were other people who were writing like tiny basics. As if you look and if you find some of those, some of them weren't too bad. And by the, as their name implies, they had to run in very small memory spaces. But getting this basic spread around as much as we did essentially preempted most development on other basics. It's a technique that Bill Gates used himself with Internet Explorer. Give it away. You'll displace the competition. But he didn't realize that, and we didn't really realize it either. All Bill Gates, you know, he took a retail view saying, I'm losing sales on this, and you guys are all thieves. And he wrote a letter to that effect to us. And in the letter, he made the mistake of saying that how he had used $40,000 worth of computer time. Now, every one of us knew that computer time was phony. Phony value. That worth of phrase was something we're very well used to. I don't think Bill Gates ever paid for his $40,000 worth of time.
No, they were using Harvard and they were using Honeywell computers at the time.
Yeah, and that was the general, you know, practice. It was more valuable to the industry to have people with the skills to do that stuff than, you know, paying for the time. It was a very, very reasonable trade-off. And you know, Bill and Paul got a lot of computer usage out of that. It's all in the history books.
I think that David Bunnell was the one that finally wrote the letter. Bill had something more extreme, and David was the PR guy there at the time. I think he tried to tone it down, but he didn't tone it down far enough to suit people.
Not far enough. No, we had a good laugh over this in the club, and we went merrily along copying and propagating the software as well as other software.
How did you get?
And then, just to wrap that up, you know, we could take some credit for Microsoft being the hegemonic company for personal computer languages.
Yep, they were.
In 77, I think, one of the semiconductor companies was introducing a microprocessor chip, and they said, okay, let's get a BASIC for this. What's the most popular BASIC? Guess what? We had made it the most popular BASIC.
Right, Microsoft BASIC, yeah.
And they were off. They were in business in the wholesale market, not the retail market.
How did you get involved with processor technology?
Well, as I said, through the social media system, community memory system, Bob Marsh looked me up. And by that time, you know, he had been a student in biology or something. I think he dropped out. I'm not sure what he did academically, but it wasn't electrical engineering. And he had worked in the field in the area in a answering machine company, and you know, he had attempted to build and partially succeeded in building a project called the TV typewriter that appeared in 1973. This was like a thermo, which used your TV for its display. And it was like catnip. You know, they got 10,000 paid responses to their, you had to send in $2 in a self-addressed stamped envelope for the plans. And a normal response would have been 20 responses. So he had learned his digital electronics the hard way, and this was a difficult thing to make work with this TV typewriter, and that impressed me. He proposed that we share a garage. He had a friend in Wisconsin somewhere who had a supply of center-cut walnut that was a certain dimension, and he thought he could use that walnut in a product like maybe a digital clock or something. So he was casting around for things to build. I, at that time, was on my own as an independent consultant and scrounging for work. And the garage cost $175 a month for a 1,200-square-foot garage. And so it was a good deal. And he, in January of 75, he showed me the article in Popular Electronics about announcing the Altair. He said, look at this. This thing is almost empty. This photo is a fake, which it was. And look at the such diagrams that they provided. There's almost nothing in there. They're going to need a lot of things to plug into it. And he, with a fellow named, that had worked at the answering machine company, Gary Ingram, and with Steve Dompier, who is a guy who is around the personal computer underground, and he was in Berkeley at that point. We were all in Berkeley. Formed a company, Processor Technology Corporation, PTCO, or sometimes they called it ProcTech, which started in that garage. And my workbench was there, and it sort of grew around me. And I began doing the schematics and the, I don't think I ever did printed circuit layout. Well, I did eventually. That sort of thing. The engineering work for their products, which started out as a ROM board, first you could store a program in it, and then a RAM board, which would actually work. The RAM boards that, the dynamic 4K RAM boards that MITS was making for the Altair did not work. They were not reliable. It was not that easy to make those dynamic memories work. So he made a static memory board, which would work every time. And at the World Altair Convention in Albuquerque in 1976, we got to look inside the Altairs that MITS themselves were using, and they were full of our memory boards. So that was processor technology. And he then came to me and said, I will pay you to design the Tom Swift terminal, but you have to do it my net way. Now, I haven't explained what that was. I had published and mimeographed and sold for 25 cents among this tiny coterie of underground enthusiasts an engineering specification for what I called a convivial cybernetic device, the Tom Swift terminal. Now, this grew out of the TV typewriter. I was at the time really the chief engineer for this community memory project, and we needed terminals that were cheaper than we could get and which also wouldn't require service contracts and so forth. So the TV typewriter seemed to offer that, but I looked it over and realized that it would not work as a terminal. The reason it wouldn't work is that it used what's called paging memory. You filled up one screen's worth of stuff, and after you typed the last character in there, the next character would cause the screen to blank, and you'd have that only that character that you just typed. That's okay for use in what is called as a character generator in videography or video work, but is not good for terminals because you'll lose your whole screen's worth with one character. So I called up Don Lancaster who had designed it. He was in Arizona. I said, why did you do this? He said, I don't know. He said, people just want to put up text on their TV screens. That's all I was doing. But he had an idea that he was working on of having using random access memory in his next design. He had been using shift register memory, which is a bucket brigade kind of thing with very high structure to it. You could put stuff in and it would disappear for thousands of clock cycles and reappear coming out the other end. You could get to it in the meantime, which meant that you could use this to keep characters refreshing on a screen, which has to be swept 60 times a second. But you had to wait for that 60th of a second to happen before you could change any of those characters. It meant that changing a character on the display screen was a slow process. But this random access memory idea promised immediate access to whatever's in the memory. I began thinking about that and realized that I could design a terminal that could grow into a personal computer. Now, the list price of the Intel 8080 chip at the time was $350. MITS was able to do the Altair because they could negotiate that down to $75 for cosmetic rejects, something none of us knew about. And so to me, it was not practical to design in a microprocessor at the outset of anything. So I did hardware. I designed hardware that would take data that's in a memory board and put it out to the video screens and interpreting the data through a chip called a character generator that made the dots of the character out of the data. And then another board that would put a data in the right place in memory so that it would show up the way you wanted it to. And I had to take into account, you know, what happens when you start a new line and backspace and do things of that sort. So I wrote all this up. The larger concept was that once you got this terminal going, you could get, like through a modem, you could dial into a real computer. But then eventually you could plug in a card that had a microprocessor and it would have your own computer and it would have random access memory, which is what a computer needs, and you could grow it. It would grow up. I defined the structure of the electrical structure of what's called the bus, the common elements, common connection elements. And so I'd done a good deal of engineering development work on this. By the time Bob Marsh came around and said he knew about this and said, do it, but do it my way. And I did. And that was the VDM video display module, VDM-1, which I got working in like October of 1975 and was eventually shipped in 1976, which in effect put a video window on top of memory that's used by the personal computer. And that's the way it's been done ever since.
Now, did that eventually become the SOL 20? I must bought one of those from Stan Veit, who had the first computer store in New York. I read someplace that when you saw an early Apple II that you decided this was a game changer. Is my memory correct? Did I read that? And if so, why was it a game changer?
Well, in effect, and I've had a chance to reflect on this recently, it was because they were playing a different game than the rest of us. They introduced at the first West Coast Computer Fair in 1977 in spring, March, April, I'm not sure. And all the rest of us, Processor Tech had a big booth there, and it was really the king of the mountain. And everything was text-based, except for some of Steve Dompier's games using text characters and little symbolic characters that were squirreled away in the character generator. Nobody was doing graphics. And there was Apple with, of all things, a video projector in their booth, color video projector, projecting graphics from an Apple II. they, as I now understand, were doing a media machine. We were doing computers. Our universe was generally circumscribed by text. And it would, you know, we knew that it would to get into graphics at a later date, but that was a kind of a sideshow. It wasn't a sideshow for Apple. It was the main act. It seems like, you know, we can credit Steve Jobs with this vision, because I know that Wozniak had been at the first Humber meeting, and he had attended them ever since, and he had set up, when we were in the Stanford Linder Accelerator Center auditorium, there was only one seat that had an electrical outlet nearby. And he would come early with his high school kid friends to claim that so he could work on developing the BASIC that he was writing for the Apple One and the Apple One hardware. And it turns out that the Apple One consisted of a little TV typewriter itself built on a board with a 6502 microprocessor chip and some memory for it, meaning that Woz's vision was not of the media machine. This was Jobs' vision. And it seems pretty clear now that you look at the history that he maintained that vision all the way along.
Oh, yeah.
So there was something, you know, you could do color graphics comparatively cheap, because Woz was a genius at squeezing performance out of chips. And so he used various ways to cheat in extracting color graphics on a TV screen from the minimum number of chips. All the rest of us would have done it the straight up and down way. Oh, you got to have three planes of memory and so forth. And everybody knows how it's got to be done. Well, Woz was not constrained by that. And he turned out something that was absolutely a game changer. And he was in a different game. Go on.
My friend, the late Stan Veit, had them show the Apple II for the first time on the East Coast at the Atlantic City Computer Show. Then he let them show it out of his booth, and Jobs took him aside and said that if he put $10,000 into Apple, he'd give him the big piece. And Stan said, if I had $10,000, I'd put it to my own company. Well, his own company went belly up, and obviously Apple didn't.
Well, yeah. Now, let me make a few corrections. I think Stan has been very astute in writing up his reminiscences, but some of them get a little mixed up. The Atlantic City computer show, PC 76 it was called,
yep,
was Labor Day 1976. And Apple had a booth there with Steve Jobs and Dan Kottke, there's a picture of this, showing off their Apple One. No graphics, not that much else. Woz was there, he was around, and we understood at that time or later that he had a cigar box version of the Apple II.
Okay.
And it would make some sense. Certainly they hadn't introduced it yet. They didn't introduce the Apple II until 77.
Right.
And so there could have been that discussion, but boy, if I were Stan, I would have done just what he did. Who are these guys?
Yeah. Down in my basement office, sitting next to my early Apple IIs that I had in early 78, is a creature of your creation, the Osborne One. How did you get involved with the volatile Adam Osborne?
Well, I was out of work again. Processor technology managed to mess up badly enough that they just closed it up and walked away from it. I'm hearing rumors about what was happening then, but these are just rumors. They do not reflect well when the people involved are not going to spread them. But, you know, all of a sudden my source of royalty income, I was getting royalties from the VDM1 and from the Sol, and I'll tell you that. Royalties are the best kind of income there is, except for tax-free. But you don't have to give them back if something goes south. but suddenly no more income. And I needed something to do. And in the 80. Fifth West Coast Computer Fair. Adam was at his booth with his publishing company. He was the one, he was doing books for personal computer programmers and other programmers, books that he was selling from the floor of the Homebrew Club. And he had maybe in the previous two years, given me some small contracts for consulting, because he had some engineers working in his back office trying to do, I guess, memory board for the S100 computers, the Altair-type computers. And he had me come in and consult as to why it wasn't working, and I could tell why it wasn't working. They were using a hopeless technique for prototyping it. And he had me do some editing work on some manuscripts. Sorry, I guess my frog is developing in my voice. So he knew something of my capabilities. And he called me from the booth and said, Lee, I want to talk to you. And he said he wanted to start a hardware company and really do things right. Now, Adam had this Gilbert and Sullivan kind of Englishman presentation. He lost his British accent when he got angry because he'd been over here for 20 years. But he was in full florid form at this point. And, of course, I would listen to anybody. So we had some meetings, and he did not specify what product he wanted to do. He asked me to come up with some ideas, which he rejected. At one point, then he said, here's what we're going to make. And he, on a piece of grid-ruled paper, carefully drew out the outline of what the Osborne 1 was. It would have two floppy disk drives, single density, 5-inch display screen. It would have a keyboard that would fold down from the front. It would fit under an airline seat. What else? He wanted it to be a CPM computer. CPM was the more or less hegemonic system, soon to be displaced by MS-DOS. But everything ran CPM except Apple. So I negotiated a contract with him as a consultant, as Golemix Incorporated, to design this thing. And, you know, have to flesh it out and develop a prototype. So for the rest of 1980, I guess the last half of 1980, I was working on that contract. And the story is told in Steve Hamm's book. I think it's called the Search for Perfect. It's something about perfect. Anyway, the story of the laptop. I told him the story of Blair Newman. I'm not going to repeat it all here. It's down in writing there, and I obviously don't have enough voice left to go through it all. But there was this idea for an outline for a personal computer, which really wound up in Adam's mind, that had been floating around the industry, having been rejected by Steve Jobs. And when you ask people who were involved, they say, that was around. That was around. But Ham did the best research I've seen on its progress. So it was this cast-off idea from a rather brilliant but erratic guy. He was he eventually committed suicide. He was bipolar. Blair Newman, whom I had come to know, and even later came to know. So I did the engineering work and designed the damn thing. What can I say? But the outline for it got set before I really had much to say about it.
I was standing at a Chicago computer show, the same one that Xerox does Eric Starr appear with Dan Bricklin? When a Sawsome rep was demonstrating Supercow on the Osborne 1, the rep didn't know who Dan was. And Dan asked him about replicate type functions, and the rep didn't know what that was. There was a copy instruction, but it only copied one thing at a time. By the time it shipped, copy had been expanded to include replication. Barbara and I taught a course at the New School in New York on using your Osborne 1. The students had to bring their Osborne to class. Stan Vito, I mentioned earlier, commented for years about seeing students wheeling their Osbornes in on airline carts. That was before the compact portable made that fashionable. I remember
and necessary.
I remember hypergrowth, the rise and fall of the Osborne Computer Corporation, the book that Adam wrote with John Dvorak about the Osborne days. It sounded very reasonable as I read through it. When I finished, though, I realized that everyone that Adam had worked with had been incompetent, duplicitous, or of other technical or business deficiencies. Adam bore no responsibility for any failings. I mentioned that to Dvorak a few years later, and he agreed, saying he was embarrassed by the book. What are your memories of Adam?
Well, Adam had a much bigger show than he had to back it up with. And he was, so I guess you would say he was a showman. You know, it's not like he had no technical chops at all. He had done computer programming he had his PhD in chemical engineering. And that was mainframe programming. He got a lot of people moving based upon the show that he could put on. He was this guy with a British accent, and of course all us American rubes think that anyone with a British accent is smarter than we are. And someone in the process eventually turned out a T-shirt within the company that says, "Adam says I can." I thought that was pretty funny. He even made up a little list of other phrases that other people in the company would have said and passed it around. But it's, you know, that indicates the kind of self-delusion in a way that made the whole thing run. If Adam says I can, then clearly I can, because he has a British accent and he's absolutely confident of himself. Well, it turns out that he, as his book indicates, he was a lousy person at choosing administrators. The hard detail work that has to be done in building a company of selecting the people that go to make it up, he wasn't much good at, by even his own admission. If you read, it doesn't even take reading between the lines. I mean, his Ben Counter, the first accountant for the company, he takes responsibility for having selected him, and he was a guy who was totally deficient. And he built a kind of a house of cards, all based on enthusiasm. I really wasn't qualified to be the vice president of engineering, which was the position I was given at that time, and I did not know how to put together an engineering department, or the fact, or what the difference was between chief engineer, engineering manager, and vice president of engineering. And nobody told me either. And I'm sure this was going on in a lot of other areas of that company, too.
And weren't you out of there before the Osborne 2 came along, the one that really didn't make it?
No, I was not out of there. I was the architectural designer of that computer, but I was not the engineer doing the actual design.
Okay.
That task fell on Kurt Ingraham, who actually was one of the engineers in the back room of Osborne Associates trying to make that memory board, and, strangely enough, had replaced me in my job at Ampex when I moved on from there.
Oh, okay.
Go figure that out. Very, very nice fellow and competent. And our Dutch VP of engineering at the time said, of Kurt. He is like a little bulldozer. He goes at a constant rate, but where he has been, it is absolutely flat. And
I
it took a while. It took like 18 months to get that thing designed.
And by that time, MS-DOS had taken over, and the Compact was just around the corner.
Right.
I note from your bio that your older brother Joseph, and the evolutionary biologist and a member of the National Academy of Sciences, developed PHYLIP, one of the earliest bioinformatics systems using your Sal and your Osborne platforms. What was that like working with him on?
Well, did I ever work with him on anything? He was 3 years older than me, starting from my birth. And we had our roles, and his was the role of teaching me and warning me away from doing anything that might get him into trouble. My role was taking orders and trying to fill the orders and trying to stay out of trouble. Joe is my most loyal customer. Almost everything that I designed, even a computer that never got manufactured, he wanted to know about and see if he should buy one. So he bought a Sal and he bought an Osborne. But during the time, he was for a while, the president, I guess, of the Northwest Computer Society. And I was getting their newsletters and stuff, and that was interesting. But I never really got involved with anything that he was doing.
Oh, okay.
It's very gratifying, you know. Keeps it in the family, and the stuff worked for him, and as well as it did for many others. You know, we made like $100,000, so sold 100,000 Osborne. We made more, but sold 100,000.
That's
maybe
great.
Maybe about 12,000 Sals.
Back to Adam. I reviewed paperback software spreadsheet program, a NumberWorks for InfoWorld, and found it rather unusable for serious work. Although I said one of two nice things. It was published under the headline, NumberWorks Doesn't, and the editor took out a few nice things that I said. I was away on vacation when InfoWorld's new editor called my office to relate that Adam had stormed in the office, calling the review unfair and incorrect. I got all upset, and I sent a copy of the uncut review and the software to Brooklyn and asked him to review it. He reluctantly agreed, not wanting to get between me and Adam, and then completely validated my review. I then sent the review to the paperback developer of the software, and he agreed with it. So I called Adam, told him that his developer had agreed with my review, and asked him if he wanted me to raise hell with InfoWorld for the cuts. He said, "Nah, it's too late. The product's dead," and thanked me for calling. And I never wrote InfoWorld again. Paucity, just doing that, really struck me. And that was after reading the book and being with him at Rosen conferences. When I remember when Tandy was doing very well, and he said from your audience to John Roach, "And you never understood why your company does well." And that was when his company was on the downswing. When you left Osborne, you went to work for Interval, a research corporation, and then to PEMSTAR, Pacific Consultants. So what did you do for those firms?
Well, let's explain a little bit further. When I left Osborne, that was September 1983.
Okay.
They basically had gone bankrupt, and I stayed around for another week or two. But I had to get some income. And I was being approached by a couple of Japanese companies to design what was supposed to become a laptop. We had five of those companies, the big ones, NEC, Toshiba, Hitachi. Was Sony in that? I'm not sure. Coming through, sending their people saying, "Please give us your exact specifications and we will quote." They were all introduced to Adam, and then he turned them over to me. So I was running a rotating five-company seminar on how to design a laptop. Because I would say to them, we do not have exact specifications. Let's discuss what you can do. And sort of we found out kind of what they could do. Well, two of the most minor companies in that batch, Ricoh and Oki, contacted me afterwards through appropriate intermediaries saying, we would like to discuss you're working for us or you're doing a development of a computer. And I wound up doing as Golemics, as a consultant, complete IBM-compatible system. And I had picked up from John Hanney, who was the last VP of engineering of Osborne pre-bankruptcy, a lot of information and wisdom about what constitutes compatibility. This was at a time when nobody really knew what it was. But Hanney was bright enough to make the declaration, better is different is incompatible. And he was right. Because software developers had used every bit in the whole system for their games and stuff. And if you didn't have a bit sitting right there where that was, even if it had no other function, your system wouldn't run their software. It was incompatible. So we were working on, when the bankruptcy came, what would have been a totally compatible IBM computer. Okay, so I left having learned some things about that, and I was able to hire some of the people that we had been using to work on this contract. It was like an $800,000 contract to develop a complete system, including hard disk controller, including a ROM BIOS, including an LCD video combination display board, all of which would be designed in a fashion that would allow it to be implemented in large-scale integration, LSI, which IBM did not, apparently. We had to analyze their work and found that there were places where their timing didn't work out. It wasn't going to work with every chip. They had, in some places, there were little sockets on their boards. What was that about? Because the chips in those sockets had to be selected, because it wouldn't work if it was slower than some requirement that was still inside the standard specs of the chip. Well, it took about 18 months. And so that was my biggest contract. I had 6 employees working on it, about 10 contractors working on it. We did it all. We made it go. And Oki, and my information there is coming from this Englishman who was their contact with me. He was the one marginally inside their organization, the guy Jim. And they basically, for marketing reasons, decided they didn't want to go forward. Ricoh had some things I could do for them, and on and on.
I remember during that time, Columbia had come out with what it said was the first compatible PC. And at that time, of course, 123 had become the killer app for the IBM PC. And I remember some of the stores in New York that had the Columbia, Brian Glass's BG Sound had it. And if a person walked in to look for an IBM computer, which only sold through Sears and Computerland and IBM's own stores, they'd be told, well, we don't have that. We have something even cheaper, the Columbia. And when the person would say, well, let me see 123 run on it, they'd say, it doesn't run under it now because Lotus violated the MS-DOS standards. But when they meet the standards, it will run. But of course, people walked out. When Compaq introduced the portable, Seven Rosen, Ben Rosen's company, had been behind Lotus, and they announced we will run every bit of business software that runs on the IBM PC. And the next version of 123 said, for the IBM personal computer, the Compaq portable, and other compatibles, and Compaq took off. So,
John Hanney that I mentioned, the first vice president of engineering who really knew what he was doing came from Texas Instruments, which is where Compaq people came from. He was in touch with him.
Sure. Rod Canyon and Jim Harris came out of TI.
Right. And there was one moment when Compaq was sort of courting to maybe buy Osborne. Didn't happen. So what happened there, of course, was that PC compatibility meant MS-DOS compatibility. That was easy to do. It's the real PC compatibility, which would play run the games and so forth.
Right.
That could not possibly have run through MS-DOS. It would have been too slow. And so the hackers at those companies had gone in there, since they had the documentation now and knew it was in the thing, and just directly accessed all kinds of stuff. So we had this suite, compatibility suite, which is, I think, four games. Frogger was one of them. Don't remember what all the others were. And that was how we were going to tell the compatibility. And it was Oki that came to me in 85 and said, we need to have a display board designed and built so it will drive this plasma display of ours as a totally IBM-compatible display. And I was able to do that because of what I had learned and so forth. So, and they used that demo to sell that product to Compaq, which was used in their, they had a plasma panel display device. Better is different is incompatible. There we are. Go on. We're next.
With the same problem with laptops, if you remember, there was some laptops that would run their own versions of DOS. So Hewlett Packard had a nice one. There was of course the TRS-80 Model 100. Data General was the first one that I remember that had a truly compatible the laptop, the DG1 and the DG1 Model 2. Then from then on, everyone had it, but it took a long time for them to be able to build compatible laptops for the same reason that you're mentioning about the other, the regular PCs and the portables.
Well, yeah, I mean, Adam Osborne thought that he could add IBM compatibility as a plug-in add-on to the Osborne, call it the Osborne 2, the executive. And in fact, there was a company that made coprocessor cards. I can't remember their name. And there was a coprocessor card for the Apple. And so Adam thought, oh, we'll do that. But that was a CPM coprocessor, not an MS-DOS or PC compatible.
He not only thought you could do it, he announced that you were going to do it.
Well, yes. I mean, that was the – people say that. The Osborne failed because it pre-announced its product. I say it failed for a compendium of other reasons. I mean, it takes more than one reason to destroy a company. You got to work at it, and they did. There was that moment at what was then the Red Lion, now the DoubleTree, in San Jose, where we did the introduction for the executive, and all the VPs, and I had VP rank at that point, although I was no longer VP of engineering, took Adam off in a corner and said, "Now, Adam, whatever you do, don't mention the IBM compatible, which is still in development." And he got up on stage, and he brought the crowd to a frenzy. And while the crowd was cheering, he added to it, "And if you think that's something, just wait till you see our IBM compatible." Now, according to the myth, the whole room would have fallen silent and said, "Really? We're not going to buy anything until we see that." But that didn't happen. They kept cheering. And it was... You know, when Adam came down off the platform, we said to him, "Adam, why'd you do it?" And he said, "Well, it's just going to be a little board that we plug in, isn't it?" You know, he had not been apprised of the work that had been done to date. And there never was a plug-in board that would do that stuff. And, you know, we were still trying to figure out what such a board would be. And what we wound up doing, he had to design an entirely completely different main board. And so that it would fit. It would, with some difficulty, it would have fit. When we wound up buying a design someone was doing for a small company called MAD, M-A-D, MAD Computers. And there's various stories behind that, but they're not very important. But the compatibility issue wasn't the big sticker. Really, what was the issue was that IBM was charging away, eating into the market. And Osborne wouldn't really take anything seriously in terms of competition. I'm afraid I fed that culture myself when it came time to review the K-Pro. But the important thing about K-Pro, you know, basically an Osborne clone, but it had a 9-inch monitor, which made it a lot heavier, a metal case, which could get dented, and, you know, but it worked. And the important thing was that when I, at one point at Osborne, the VP of marketing proudly showed me a file cabinet full of folders, and there's a separator, and about one-fifth of those was in front of the separator. These were applications for dealerships, and only the ones in the front section were approved, and the marketing VP was very proud of that fact, and I'm sure Adam was very proud of that fact about the high quality of everything associated with Osborne Computer, dealership, and so forth. Well, what were those other guys going to do? K-Pro would ship a single computer COD by UPS, you know, to anybody. You know, computers on approval, in effect. And so all of those other people who wanted to be Osborne dealers but couldn't could be K-Pro dealers.
The other thing that K-Pro did was they seeded the press with K-Pros for like a dime on the dollar. I remember William F. Buckley had one. Dan Berrigan had one. Joe King, who was one of the hosts on the Press Computer Show, the New York had one. A whole lot of people had K-Pros that wrote about them, and or used them to write with. And I all used WordStar, and they were all K-Pro fans, right up in the Osborne one.
Yeah, well, the Osborne one had a 5-inch screen. And while we made good use of that screen, nonetheless, it's still a 5-inch screen. And this type was literally the size of the type in the Wall Street Journal. That was one of my excuses. But the 5-inch screen was dictated by Adam at the beginning. And it turns out that it was a good call at the time because the IBM had introduced the portable computer. A 30-pound box, which is basically a basic and APL calculator with a full keyboard.
And it didn't run 1-2-3.
There wasn't 1-2-3 to run it. It introduced it in 1975.
It was
really, it had been developing it for a while. Yeah, it was for scientific users and so forth. There's an answer to, I think, HB's 85 or something.
The other thing, the compact.
Well, may I?
Go ahead.
Just complete here. That one used a 5-inch display monitor. And they took that out of production in 1979, and there were three manufacturers who were selling the same monitor, compatible monitor for that. We could pick them up at a very low cost. So good idea from the outset, but we should have been moving up, and we did. So we moved up to a 7-inch monitor for the executive. But the executive took so long to get to market and had relatively small increments of performance that, actually by the time it got there, it really was too late. The company was moribund.
The other thing that Compaq did extremely well was IBM had a exclusive with Sears and with Computerland. The Computerland was already selling Apples, but on the MS-DOS side, they could only sell IBM machines. When Compaq was introduced, they talked about how that they were not in competition with IBM, that everyone should have an IBM PC, but some people, they will need to take things to hotels, on airplanes, home. So we're a complementary machine. They're able to get into Sears and to Computerland, saying that we're not in competition with IBM. 2.5 years later, they introduced the Desk Pro, and I was there, and someone in the audience stood up and said, "I've thought you weren't in competition with IBM." And they said, "Well, our customers wanted the faster machine, and ours is built on the 8286 processor, and on and on and on, and the 8086, and they stole the show."
That was pretty bright of them. My hat's off to them.
Lee, I'm worried that we're not going to get through all of the current stuff that I want to with you because of the depth we've been going into. Okay. Is there any problem with you coming back for another session in a couple of weeks?
No, there's no problem.
Okay. In 2003, you worked on this open source telecommunications system to be installed in different places in the developing world. I remember talking to you about it after it was featured in the New York Times Magazine. What's the status of that project, and was it ever implemented?
The original project never really worked. We went to Laos with it, and I had not developed and no good appreciation of the degree of software development that was necessary for it. I did some good hardware, but we couldn't make the software work. And in fact, when we were there, we had a massive crash. The development system, I still have my suspicions about it, but can't prove it, that it was, in fact, it was not inherent, let's say. But the foundation, the Jai Foundation, J-H-A-I, went back afterwards and made an attempt to install something. But what happened was that I really had burned off all my vacation time in 2002 developing that. I was working at PEMSTAR Pacific Consultants at the time. So I had to do this on the side. And I couldn't afford to keep working on it. Besides, the issues were now software. So I looked up Bob Marsh. And as I had done a couple of times in the past, said, "Here, I've got this baby. You take the baby." And he, very fortunately for the whole thing, was in fact retiring at that point. He agreed to do it, and he put together a team, mostly software people, and they got dissatisfied working under the management of the head of the foundation, and they split off. They formed their own company. It was a nonprofit. I advised them not to do that because everybody in Silicon Valley, when they hear nonprofit, their ears close and they say, "Oh, you're just going to hit me for money." But they managed to make a go of it. The name of the company is Invenio, I-N-V-E-N-E-O, it's a .org. And they are successful. They basically went into the business. First of all, they took NGOs as their clients, which is very smart. And they worked out generations of hardware, and now it's software, for installation in mostly Africa, but basically in remote locations. And what is the backbone for them is the Wi-Fi network. That's something that I had defined for the Laos system. And they were able to install a Wi-Fi network, a wide area network, well, a wide area network of small locations, access points, in Haiti, right, 2 weeks after the earthquake.
And, wow.
They most recently they were being asked to come in and help on the Ebola crisis. So you can look them up, and they are basically the continuation of that effort. I haven't really been involved in it, and that's sort of what I do, is I start, it's arrogant to say this, but I start industries. I mean, sometimes the industries go nowhere. Then I tend to move on. I will stick around at some points to develop products, but that's...
But that's terrific. That's a continuation, really, all the way of your community memory project back in the in the 70s. All right.
Yeah, you can say that. That's right.
And speaking of that, and your bio under the heading of the People's Computer Company, you have this saying, if work is to become play, then tools must become toys. Does that saying still your mantra?
It is not only my mantra. I've been spending the last weekend industriously working on getting the device ready that will implement that. In other words, I'm getting into the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, math.
Let's hold that until the next
later.
Session,
because
we won't be able to do it effectively in 15 minutes. I have scheduled three mystery writers over the next 3 or 4 weeks. Can we do this in about a month again, at a date that we both agree to?
Yes, we can.
Okay, well,
as you can probably tell, I will talk at the drop of a hat.
That's okay. Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you, Lee.
That's nice too.
I'll send you the URL shortly after we get off. The bit of commercial information, my column appears weekly in the Westchester Guardian, along with regular columns by ex-congressperson and co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, Lee Hamilton, critic John Simon, and historian Daniel Pipes. The Westchester Guardian is available in print format and online at www.westchesterguardian.com. My books are available at Amazon, and I blog at opensalon.blogs/johnmack13. The blog, by the way, is available automatically on Kindles for the exorbitant cost of 99 cents per month. And in the words the Met radio announcer Howie Rose, if the Mets win, put it in the book. Go to my website, JohnMack13, www.johnmack13.com, for the URLs of previous shows. And until then, tune in next week to hear the 79th show in the series with mystery and suspense writer F. Paul Wilson. And until then, as they used to say in the old neighborhood, see ya. Whoa, Silver. Whoa. Stay big fella. Thanks again, Lee.
Okay.